and to communicate to a very Canadian audience through a Canadian perspective on that. And today I'm going to talk a little bit more about food security and gender and food security, and again highlighting the challenges and the great experiences that women can bring to ending hunger, and then offer you an action that you and we can all take together in responding to the needs around the world. Now, I think most of you are very familiar with the Canadian Food Greens Bank, so I'm just going to whip through a couple of slides just in case you are unfamiliar. And if you are interested in a few more materials after we've done our formal part, I did bring some annual reports and a few other documents. So if you are interested in some recent materials from the Food Greens Bank, you can get those. So those are the 15 church members. We're truly a big tent organization with virtually every Canadian Christian denomination represented there, including MCC, of course. And those 15 church denominations, apparent or church member organizations, apparently represent 29 church denominations in total. In the last fiscal year, we provided over $40 million worth of assistance to 837,000 people in 36 countries. The majority of people and dollars were spent in Africa. The biggest responses were in DR Congo, which links to our conversation earlier this morning, Ethiopia, Kenya. Those are the top three in the last year in Africa. And then Asia would be the second major area, and that would be very much in Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Yemen. So in those parts of the world, much more responding to conflict and food assistance. If we're going to divide, I should trust the clicker, but I feel like I always have to look back just to make sure it actually did work. So far working, so 60% of the dollars spent by the Food Greens Bank go towards meeting emergency food needs in times of crisis. About 35% is trying to look at long-term development needs and providing training and support for agriculture and livelihoods. 5% towards nutrition programs, especially for women and children. Now, none of that is actually, or it's not quite so cut. I mean, there's nutritional aspects to different programs, etc. But if you were going to divide it up, that's about where things fall. And then, in addition to the actual programming work, we have the public engagement department that works to deepen the understanding and engagement of Canadians in the work of ending hunger. And then me and a few other colleagues in the public policy department that work specifically in trying to look at bigger system change in a way, but also within a fairly achievable framework of trying to push the Canadian government to do more in terms of the Canadian government policies to do more and to do better in their activities in their overseas international assistance. I'll go back to a couple of numbers that I mentioned last week. So we, as the Food Greens Bank, can reach somewhere in the neighborhood through our members and through our partners in 850,000 people. The number of hungry people who do not have enough food on a regular basis for active, healthy lives, is more in the neighborhood of 821 million people. So while we are making a dent, the problem continues to be quite enormous. 1 in 9 people in the world without sufficient access to food. Far too many. So in light of that, and this goes back to last week a little bit as well, why are we talking about women? Why are we, in some ways, at the Food Grains Bank, we focus and we work and we provide food assistance and we provide training to both men and women. Both men and women obviously face hunger. Both men and women are active in agriculture, which we'll talk a little bit more about. But at the same time, in every region of the world, women are more likely to experience hunger than men. And I think I think if I can remember what I said last week, I talked a little bit about that women tend to sacrifice food intake in these times of crisis, and that women, even when times are good because of various social values and cultural practices, often do not get as much food as men or are eating less nutritious food, etc. So not always substantially difference, but there is a difference in terms of food access for women compared to men. And many of these women work in agriculture. In fact, in the poorest countries in the world, women who are active are 79% of those work in agriculture, are involved in agriculture, either on their own farms or as farm laborers on others, or farming together with their husbands, whatever the situation is. So by far, in the poorest countries in the world, women are deriving their livelihoods from agriculture. And women are often responsible for planting, for weeding, doing the harvest activities, etc. So there's often a split in that who does what, but women very involved. Oh, see. There we go. Women face disproportionate barriers in achieving and in their livelihood in agriculture. So all farmers face challenges in terms of weather, in terms of increasing challenges from climate change, in accessing financial services, but those are greater in most cases for women. So, a few things. Women. One major barrier for women is access to productive resources and services. And so when we talk about that, we're talking about things like land, seeds, water, finance, education, training, access to labor on their farms. So if women are heads of household, they often find it hard to find people to actually work on their farms. Men don't necessarily want to be hired by a woman. So that can be a challenge. Women represent less than 5% of agricultural landholders in North Africa and West Asia, 15% of landholders in sub-Saharan Africa. So if you think about the number who are actually working in agriculture versus the number who actually control and actually have access to their own land and can control that land, it's a very different number. In terms of finance, women, it's hard to invest in a farm if you, A, don't control the land, and also if you don't have access to finances like loans. So women in Africa receive just 10% of all loans. And even when they receive the loans, they don't necessarily control what happens with the money. Lack of knowledge. Women have less access to formal education and farm training. 2/3 of the people who cannot read or write in the world today are women. And only 5% of all extension services are directed towards women. So when we think about training and learning about how to integrate new practices, et cetera, into your farm, those farm trainings might be held too far away from farms, so women have less ability to travel greater distances, so they might not be able to access those, or they're held at times where women are too busy doing childcare or other things, or the materials provided for the agricultural trainings are written and are not, therefore, women who are not able to read and write can't access those trainings, etc. So there's a lot that can be done to improve access to resources for women. If we did that, if women farmers, this is a study from the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, if women farmers had the same access to resources as men, their yields on their farms would increase by 20 to 30%. And that would have a knock-on effect of decreasing hunger in the world by 100 to 150 million people. That would have an enormous impact on when we think about those levels of hunger in the world. Now, I want to stop there for a second and just say the danger sometimes in talking this way is that we sort of instrumentalize women. So we say we need to do more for women so that we can have this other impact, so it can help other people, so that we can have, you know, economic impact, etc. And so let me just say that the first reason that we should increase the equality of women is because women are equal to men, and so should be treated as such everywhere in the world, regardless of what other kinds of impacts there might be. So, you know, part of the reason we should care about women is because simply they are not treated equally in so many parts of the world and in our own world. And then I'm going to go back to talking about some of the impacts and some of the other benefits of working towards equality in agriculture in this case. Another barrier for women is the time barrier, and many of us know exactly what I'm talking about. Women spend approximately 2.5 times as much time on unpaid labor as men. So we're talking about the time spent in childcare, the time spent taking care of relatives, elderly relatives, the time spent collecting water in these communities. If you remember the film last week, Lucy or her children collected water numerous times a day. The time spent collecting firewood in places where there isn't access to appropriate fuel. That has a huge impact on the time available to work on those productive work like on the farm. So if you're spending so much time just trying to get through the activities, the unpaid activities of the day, however do you flourish in an employment capacity? And so for women, that's a huge barrier on their farms. And then the third barrier is the barrier of decision-making or agency or autonomy. Joyce this morning spoke about women's agency as it relates to sexual violence. And women on farms and women in many places do not have the ability to make the choices to determine their own lives. In our context in agriculture, do not work together with their husbands if they're farming together to make the decisions about how money is spent on their farms. If they're farming alone, it's difficult for them to have the kind of agency and freedom to make the choices that they would like to make and that they need to make. And when women have more ability to make those decisions around their finances, for example, they tend to pour a lot of that money right back into their families, into the health and education of their children, etc. And so men and women tend to spend money differently. And so when they work together, and women also have the capacity and the ability and the agency to make decisions, their families and themselves are better off. That's pretty small. So just quickly, so how can we improve and ensure that women are treated equally in on their farms? For one thing, we can work to improve access to those productive resources, and Food Grains Bank projects and the work that we do with the Canadian government is always urging improved agricultural extension services targeting women, etc., and improving access to land, improved seeds, etc. Working to improve women's agencies, the rights and the capacity of women to make their own choices. And the third, taking collective action. Working in groups, women can overcome gender discrimination more effectively. This applies whether the group is about learning or managing money or marketing together. So in the film last week, you saw that Lucy is part of a number of savings groups that come together, they learn together, and often also end up advocating together. So they use their, when they come together and have a collective voice, that also works to improve their own agency and their ways of advocating for themselves and their communities. This is where I would have shown the video. So here comes the part that links to us and to advocacy and actions that we can take. Wait, I think I skipped ahead there. There we go. So there, from our own experience and from the experience of others, we know that a lot of good can be achieved by connecting equality, gender equality, with agriculture and food security. That there is huge progress that could be made in ending hunger. Canadian government knows that too, by the way, because the Canadian international assistance policy is very much focusing on improving gender equality to end poverty and hunger around the world. But what they're not doing is investing very much in agriculture. So if we go back to that number, 79% of poorest women working in agriculture, and we have a Canadian government that's not particularly interested in supporting agriculture, there's a rather large disconnect. So I was told I have a laser. I'm going to see if this laser works. Yeah, I don't think so. Oh, am I just not, am I nowhere close to the screen? Oh, there we go. Okay. First of all, the red bars is showing how there was progress in hunger. And if we went further back, you'd see a much more significant line of progress in achieving ending hunger. And then in the last 3 years, the darker red lines are showing how that number is now on the rise again, linked very much to the challenges posed by climate change as well as increased conflict in the world. And then if you look at, and now let's see if I can do this again. Now if you look at that line, that's Canada's aid for agriculture. It's on a downward trajectory, and when we look at forward project commits, which is basically what the Canadian government has said it's going to continue to invest in agriculture in the future, it's going down even further. So there is a loss of interest from our government in recognizing the value of agriculture. If you're curious about that spike back in 2009, that would be the global food crisis and the global economic crisis, and Canada and other G7 countries came together and said, oh, maybe we should be doing something to support agriculture. And for about 3 years, they were really focused, and then they got distracted. And I want to put that within the larger aid package. So agricultural development is just one aspect of the overall, what Canada does overall. And many Canadians, and I think you guys are more educated probably in global issues than many Canadians, but many Canadians think Canada is very generous in what we do in terms of our international assistance. And let me show you on, wait, I can do this again, perhaps. So this globally agreed amount is 0.7%. That is a target that was agreed to by Lester B. Pearson, former Canadian Prime Minister, and others, who said what, and there's a whole Pearsonian doctrine behind that I'm not overly familiar with, that agreed that 0.7% of GNI, global national income, or essentially the wealth that we have as a country, that is the target that all developed countries, donor countries, should be aiming for reaching in terms of what we do to contribute to ending poverty around the world. Most of our sort of peer countries around the world who are similar economy, similar wealth, on average, they're giving about 0.5%. Canada is currently at about 0.28%. And as you can tell, we used to do much, much better. I don't know if you can see the countries, but just to compare us to some other countries. Canada's down there with Australia, Japan, and US. And the countries, not surprisingly, the Northern European countries Sweden, Norway, UK, Netherlands are substantially more generous than we are. And I just heard last week that Spain has a new center-left government, and they have pledged in their policy platform to double their international assistance in the coming years. So Spain may be on that, and they're moving ahead. And Britain, which is going through, as you know, some significant problems, is absolutely committed to remain at 0.7% of their wealth, despite the turmoil going on in their country. In fact, it's enshrined in legislation in Britain that they must continue to achieve 0.7%. And just another slide that you probably can't see very well, but if you can see the red and the blue lines, then you can see that red is liberal and blue is conservative. How we do in terms of our generosity as a country is not dependent on what party is in power. So this is a nonpartisan issue. We have done very well under conservatives and liberals, and we've done very poorly. And that first initial dive was in the years of Chrétien when he was cutting and working very hard to balance budgets. And that came in some substantial way off the backs of ending poverty in other countries. So that's a little bit of a primer on where Canada actually stands. So I'm going to... Should I stop and take some questions in between and before I jump into talking about the action part of this? So, any questions? Yep. That's you. Oh, there's a mic. Okay.
Yes. When you said 1 in 9 people don't have enough food or insufficient nutrition, where is that distributed in the world? Or is it concentrated in certain places? Or is it general in some general?
The continent where progress has been the slowest and almost negligible is Africa. So there's been huge progress over the last years in Asia. Sub-Saharan Africa and other parts of Africa is where we're seeing the increases coming from. And then, interestingly, in the last paper or the report from the United Nations said that hunger is on the rise in parts of Latin America. And so I think that would be very conflict-connected. So Latin America, still the numbers overall in Latin America are very low, but there is a rise, and then Africa. Right.
The question I have is, how many generations is it going to take for the women to have their sons learn that there's equality between men and women? And then further to that is, second part, the political powers in those countries. Will they ever be able to be shamed into giving back into agriculture? Because they sure live very affluently.
Okay. Those are two quite different questions. I'm going to try to remember them. You can remind me if I forgot. So how long will it take? Well, that is a good question. I don't know. We're talking... So we often talk about... from a programming perspective, we talk about two different kinds of program: gender sensitive, gender transformative. So when we're talking about gender sensitive, you know, it might be increasing access to those kinds of resources without actually trying to challenge structures, power systems, etc. There's a certain amount of change, and that change will take time, as it has. That change takes time in our society as well. But that change is happening. There's lots of work on that. Transformative change, the change that actually is going to change the way we actually see each other, work together, the power dynamics of societies that, as you are saying, as part of the second question, require in some way for there to be an acknowledgement that the current system doesn't work well for everyone. But there are people who benefit from the system remaining the way it is. I can't tell you how long that it will take for that change to happen. We're still working on that change. So we think a lot about how to work with that sort of more transformative change. And so in some of the work that we do and other organizations do, work with gender champions in communities, and those often are men. And men of prestige in communities. So when those men start learning more about how the entire community benefits when they work better with women and girls in their communities, that's when a deeper level change can start happening. But that requires men to truly be allies in that process, and a change in those attitudes. So I don't have an answer. You probably didn't think I would have an answer for exactly how long it's going to take. In approximately 2036, we should achieve. How do you work with governments? Again, that is a long-term challenge as well. And we see progress in some governments, and then we see government like Tanzania, which is really being quite regressive currently in terms of taking rights away from women that had already been achieved in the past. So that is a challenge. Now there is in terms of supporting agriculture, a number of African countries have pledged, and there is and I'm forgetting what it's called, but there is a goal agreed by many African countries to try to reach 10% of their own budgets to put into Africa, agriculture, and a number of countries are achieving that. And Ethiopia had huge strides in investing more of their own income and their own wealth back into agriculture. So there are countries that are recognizing how important that is. Obviously, they don't have the income sources that is sufficient for them, and so that's where aid needs to play a role as well.
You get support in various ways. What percentage of your support comes from these growing projects across the country? If we think about the Canadian Food Grains Bank, I'm assuming some of your money comes from the denominations that are part of it. They would make an annual donation or whatever. The GROW projects have been growing, I understand, and I'm just curious to know whether they've become a significant portion of your income matched by the federal government or where that stands.
Okay. Thank goodness I brought my annual general report along. Growing in community project donations last year were just over $7 million. So we have an annual budget of $40 million. So I don't do math, but you can figure out about what percentage that is. Overall donations, and so that includes donations coming from our member houses, so they would get the church denominations, then the members would transfer. That was $13 million. So about $20 million. We have an annual grant for the food assistance work we do from the Canadian government of $25 million a year. And then there was, so the project that Lucy was a part of in the film is called Scaling Up Conservation Agriculture in East Africa. And that is a separate grant from the Canadian government of $14 million or so over 5 years. And then we also get some support from other foundations. Okay. You can continue to ask questions, but this is the part where I go, okay, here's something that you can do. And if I can link back to Joyce's message this morning, how we can be light in the world. This is one way. So if we think about getting involved with the Food Grains Bank, obviously giving is an important aspect, and we are so blessed to have so many generous donors across Canada, and especially those who who are contributing and participating in growing projects. It's amazing. It's not really my world, but giving is certainly one important response. Praying is an important response, praying both for us but also for change in the world. Learning, which is part of the reason I'm here, is a response. And then advocating. And I feel like that it's probably not a super hard sell in this church, but you never know. There's a variety of people in every church. But advocating is certainly something that we think is part of a biblical response to injustice and inequality in the world. People such as Esther and Moses spoke for those who had no voices themselves, but were greatly affected by the decisions made by powerful people. After fasting in the desert, Jesus went on to advocate for the impoverished and marginalized people in his public ministry. And we can also use our voices. We have elected officials in Ottawa who are there to represent us and our values and our concerns. And if they don't hear from us, how would they know what matters to us and how we would like them to make decisions on our behalf? So we have something called a harvest of letters. In response to the falling aid for agriculture, within that broader context of decreasing support for aid overall in Canada, we're asking people to write letters to their member of parliament to say, this isn't right. We would like to see Canada be more generous rather than less generous and continue to support farmers, especially women farmers who need it. So this is going to be an activity, an action that you can do in the next 30 minutes. If you don't want to do that, obviously you don't have to. But I will invite you to take some time to write a letter. So I'm going to let you come up to the front. This brochure has a sample letter, so we've done some of the work for you. But in very old school fashion, and those of you who have gray hair will remember this practice of putting pen on paper and writing, we are told by member of parliament after member of parliament that if you take that time to write something by hand, they will know that you took the time to write something by hand and will know that it means more than simply hitting send on somebody else's email or electronic postcard. So it's not, it's surprisingly challenging to actually write a letter, but it has impact. And we're told that repeatedly. So there is paper up at the front, blank paper or lined paper if you prefer. We also have envelopes to put in your member of parliament. And if you don't happen to know who your member of parliament is, there's a handy-dandy way we can find that out for you. And there's pens, too. So I'm hoping that you're willing to do this. And if you're not, have a conversation with your neighbor, wave me over and ask me hard questions. Ask me a question now.
Wait one second. We'll have Henry had his hand up first here.
I don't know where this fits in. It came from last week's conversation. Having grown up on a farm where we did hand labor, from cleaning the barn every day to topping sugar beets and throwing them on the truck and husking our corn and throwing them on the rack, our vision was machinery. And that's what changed the way we did things. The two women, the one obviously came from here, from Manitoba, could only do the work that they're doing because of machinery.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I realize the costs that machinery entails, and the attitude towards that. What is the discussion, or do you have the discussion? Has machinery any place in the solution for the women that we saw?
I think the answer, and I immediately want to look to Alden, who's my old former colleague, who probably has much greater insight into this. I mean, this is about access to income, obviously, and the ability to move towards mechanization. So being able to find ways to do the kinds of activities required on the farm in ways that are less labor-intensive. Absolutely, there's place for that. The question is about how to access appropriate technology and mechanization in ways that is actually affordable. And I know that we have certainly tried not to be the kind of aid agency that's simply handing out things to people, and that would not be affordable for us either. Labor-saving devices and ways of working that save time and labor is absolutely something that is part of that work towards achieving equality. Yeah. Alden.
Yeah, good response. I might add, in terms of mechanization, that definitely has been an area that you see more and more women and men using, in the same way I think Mennonites have over the years. Just to mention a couple, one is called a ripper, which basically you, instead of doing it by hand, you pull a blade through the soil that opens it up on their minimum tillage systems, and you put the seed in, so that saves a lot of work. There is a hand planter. Instead of throwing seeds into the ground, it's a small unit which has a sharp point on it. You push it into the ground, you open it up, the seed and the fertilizer drops, you pull it out of the ground, and you go to the next spot. And then there's more tractors in a lot of these places that are being used to do some of the initial tillage work if they're doing a more intensive tillage operation. So that's definitely happening.
There's one other quick question.
Now, I also grew up on the farm. I had a mother and a father. The mother had no say whatsoever what went on the farm. How is that different than what's happening in Africa? That puzzles me.
Right. It may not be different than what's happening in Africa. I mean, there are challenges in all areas, and she may not have wanted to have say in some of the decisions made on the farm. You know, when we're talking about equality, it isn't that everybody has to be exactly the same. It's that people have freedom and the ability to make the choices that they want to make. So, you know, whether your mom, perhaps she did have dreams or choices that she wasn't able to make because she didn't have that agency. Perhaps she did, and that was the choice that she made. So, you know, it isn't just that we're saying that, you know, these women have to take control. It's that they need to, that we believe that agency is important to make those kind, to decide what are the choices that they want to have. And in many cases, these women are also farming on their own. So in the case of Lucy, when her husband is further away, and we're seeing an increasing feminization of agriculture. So because of economic challenges, men are leaving the farms and looking for work elsewhere. Women, again, don't have the agency and the autonomy to actually be able to do that. So they're left trying to struggle on a farm and make a living without actually having a lot of that agency that allows them to go out and work it in the same way that their husband would if he was there. Does that make sense? So it isn't necessarily different, but it might be, because I don't know the individual context, but we're all in a process of working through these things. Okay.
We happened to be in Mexico during the shortly after the free trade agreement came into effect, and the impact that this had on farming in the smaller communities of southern Mexico. At the time, there were a lot of farms that had half an acre or a little strip of land along a hillside, and the family farmed this, and they did quite well. It provided employment for the family, but once mechanization came in, then the farmers had to be amalgamated, and corporations came to buy up these little plots, and then they put up tractor, and the tractor did the work of what the family used to do. And so a lot of people were left unemployed and went to the United States to find work. And so this was a downside of mechanization for a lot of the people in southern Mexico.
Mechanization or also opening of those borders and to dumping of American corn and so forth. I mean, there are broader problems, but there is the so we talk about appropriate technology or appropriate mechanization. One more question, and then I'm going to stop it for now.
And Carol, another thought just to think, what about even telling us how to write and what to write? Because some of us would love to take it home, maybe.
Okay.
But
well, this is going to tell you some of what to write, but obviously we're keen to have you personalize it. But I'm going to, I'll go back to that in a second.
Mine isn't a question. I just wanted to share an experience. As most of you know, I've been to Uganda a few times, working first in a school. The first time I went, I wasn't exposed to any of this, but the second time I went, I was taken to a women's collective, very much like the one we saw in the video last time. These women banded together. They put a little bit of money into the pot each time, and then if a woman had an emergency situation, she could come and borrow money from the collective to, or whatever. They had a name for it. I don't remember the name for it. And they were able to help each other out. And then the next time I came, I visited three other groups like that, where women and men got together to help each other in agriculture. They were all agricultural projects. And what the women then, I had an opportunity to go around and see some of the projects. So one woman cemented the floor of her cow shed so she could milk and sell the milk. You have to have a cement floor to sell milk in the village. So she cemented her floor with money that she got from the collective. Another group of women got together and they planted tomatoes in the swampland because in the off season, tomatoes garnered a lot of money in the market. And so they were able to sell their tomatoes off season because they got this, they worked on this land in the swamp and had water in the off season so that they could grow their tomatoes and sell them. And when I talked to some of the women, one of the things in Uganda and probably other parts of Africa, I'm only more familiar with Uganda than other places, is that a lot of these women, their husbands who also had land, had multiple partners and wives. And so it is the woman who has to do the education of the children. She has to have the money for emergencies. And even something like a funeral can totally wipe you out forever. And so these collectives of women putting little bits of money in is what keeps them from destitution. And so I think that's a really a powerful thing that can happen. And I was privileged to be able to be seeing some of those projects when I was there. And I think that education of women, and for them it was having that little bit of extra money that they had access to, that they didn't have to go to a formal institution to get money. That was the important thing. So I didn't really have a question, but I just wanted to say that it just really made a difference for a lot of these women and what they could do. I also saw a hair salon, because hair is an expensive piece of Africa. You have to get your hair done very regularly, and unless you want it shaved, you have to pay for it. So one woman in her village built a hair salon. So there was different ways that they used the money, not just agriculture, but other ways as well.
Okay, thank you for sharing. I'm going to move quickly now. So, Dieter, you asked a good question. Can we just take these home? And absolutely you can. Here's my plea for why I really hope you do it here in our remaining time. One, because there's something about community and collective action of doing an action together that I think is valuable as a church community. Two, we really want to count how many letters there are. And that helps us to know what impact our advocacy is having. And three, but despite your real best intentions, when you go home and you make lunch and I don't know, you watch the Jets game tonight, it's much less likely that you actually are going to write the letter. So, if you can come up, those of you who are willing to do this, come up, grab one of these sample letters, some paper, a pen, and your envelope, and I can circulate around and answer any other questions. I know, that's because if you are worried about writing straight or if you like to use freehand.
So this is the one?
That's the one. No, but, well, you can find it. Or wave to me and I'll find it on my phone real quickly.